Today's show is brought to you by TheBeehive.com. Go there. Everything you've ever wanted in your life is there. You, if what do you want? Oh, I want eternal happiness. Go to TheBeehive.com. Done. Oh, I want the perfect body with perfect abs. Go to TheBeehive.com.
Don't need it. Already got it.
Don't need it. Already got it because you went to TheBeehive.com.
Exactly. I learned about TheBeehive.com many moons ago when I was just schlubbing around and I said, yeah, I'd love the six-pack and big old traps and just nice mane that was groomed correctly. I went to the Beehive. That's what I became. Now, that's what you're looking at now, Clint.
TheBeehive.com has everything you'll ever need. It's a big deal. It's becoming an even bigger deal. You can follow the Beehive on Clubhouse.
Yes.
I think people should do that.
Yeah, we just created a club. I didn't even know this was happening until a few days ago.
The Beehive created a club. You're not an admin.
Well, I got an invite to join my own club, and I said,
"You're not an admin.
I don't think this is how clubs work."
You're not an admin.
Just a low-level participant.
You're a custodian.
Maybe. I'm at the very... So
you clean things up in there.
Clubhouse, which is just a platform where people go and listen to like one person or two people talk, and you sit in the audience, you know, in hard air quotes. I'm the furthest back audience member. That's how that club works. So I go into the Beehive and
low,
I'm way back. Don't have a chair, not even a folding metal chair.
You're the lowest.
I'm on the ground. Hey, quick question back here. They go, sounds like there's no more questions. So thanks for coming onto our clubhouse today.
So follow the Beehive on Clubhouse. We have a club.
We're going to start doing some freaky stuff on there.
You can become a member. I'm not entirely sure how you become a member, but if you ask me if you to become a member, I will say yes. So
I thought anybody could join. Is that not how
there's,
it works?
There's follow and there's members. I'm not entirely sure how Clubhouse works quite yet, but you're in. Go to Clubhouse, follow the Beehive.
Go everywhere.
Go to TheBeehive.com. You can watch all the segments of your choice. TheBeehive.com is you know, there's a million amazing things coming up on TheBeehive.com.
Do you want to wake up every morning at 8 a.m. Rocky Mountain time and watch a nice clean stream of just some good
just
folks? Some good folks saying clean things for an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, maybe less. We don't know, but it's clean and it's a couple clean.
Do you like
people.
Dry bar comedy? Then you'll love the Beehive.
Do you like taking showers? Do you like washing your hair? We'll go to TheBeehive.com.
We also talked to Dr. Karen Anderson today. She's a writer, an author, written several books, teaches creative writing at the Utah Valley University.
Our actual alma mater, which is not called the Utah Valley University.
And I also talked to Vasion CEO Ryan Wiedig, old Ryan Wiedig down there in St. George. An impressive fella.
Yeah.
That guy's ripped.
He could bench press both of us at the same time.
That guy is ripped. Every time I see him, he's got this nice, like...
He's gone to TheBeehive.com!
He's got the shirt that's, like, up to here. It's, like, tight.
Don't
he's got the V-neck. Only if you work out can you wear the V-neck.
Well, it sucks because...
Look at me right now. If I worked out, I wouldn't have this black thing underneath.
I want everybody who's watching this on video to imagine if Clint wasn't wearing the black undershirt underneath that jersey right now. What you would be looking at. The exact opposite of Ryan Wiedig. Just be this little guy over there. Oh, man.
I'm no Ryan Wiedig, no, and I've never claimed to be.
You know what? You haven't. And I like that about
I've
you.
Never
You're claimed. A realist, dude.
I've never claimed to be. All right, so go to TheBeehive.com and follow and become a member of The Beehive on Clubhouse. Clubhouse is going to be important for The Beehive moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
So make sure you follow us on Clubhouse, only if you have an iPhone.
Yeah, you can. Not everybody can do it.
It's not my fault. I don't make the rules. If you have an Android, you can't do it.
I still can't get over how weird that is, but whatever.
If you have an Android, you can't do it quite yet. That's on Clubhouse. That's not on us. We had nothing to do with that. And now, let's Beehive. You are looking alive on a Monday. Boy, is it Monday. Boy, are you alive. My name is Clint Betts.
My name is Chris Rawl.
So much going on in the world today.
It's a Monday. It's March. The March Madness is on its way. Players' Championship is this week. I don't know. Maybe the Masters is less than a month away. Oh, NBA is coming back from the All-Star break. NHL. Do the Matthew McConaughey over there. Matthew McConaughey, probably more of your contemporary, you know, than Ryan Wiedig.
Matthew McConaughey's way ripped.
Yeah, well, but he loves ice, and you do too. Pebbled ice.
Maybe Matthew McConaughey in the movie that he won the Oscar.
A Dallas Buyers Club.
Yeah, Dallas Buyers Club.
That is a good contemporary
where
for you.
Where he's just riddled with disease.
Everybody goes, yeah, that dude literally had to lose 100 pounds. And he was like 180 pounds normally. He lost 100 pounds for his role. Everybody sees him on screen. They
just
go,
sickly.
That's a pretty good doppelganger for Clint Betts. That's what it would look like if he wore a jersey without anything underneath. Have you ever worn a jersey just bare?
No. Not since I was a kid.
You're a modest man. I like that.
I refuse to do it. I mean, what am I doing? Selling sex?
First thing I think about.
Do I sell sex?
I don't know.
Am I out here promoting my OnlyFans account? OnlyFans.com/ClintBetts?
I don't know if you do or do not sell sex. That's on you. I'm not going to judge you for it. I do know that I've never seen you in a jersey without anything underneath.
I sell sex, but only on OnlyFans. That's another thing. OnlyFans is going to be very big for the BI moving forward. OnlyFans.com/ClintBetts. That's when you'll see me without the undershirt.
Jersey only.
Jersey only. Exact same show.
I don't sell sex, but I sell my body. You know, so
plasma.
Oh yeah,
kidneys.
Just for anything, exactly. Hair follicles, little saliva. That's $10 right there. You owe me. You owe me for that right there.
So how are you? You doing good? You have a good weekend?
I can't even believe that transition. I did have a good weekend. Yes, I played a lot of golf. I feel good about it. The sun was shining. I got my legs out. As anybody's watching video can see underneath this desk. Yeah, the legs are out. They're out and about. Check them out, dude. Doing good. Look at them. Look at them.
I would never wear shorts. Oh my God.
You wear shorts, but you wear jeans underneath.
Okay. So, wow.
Yeah.
Good weekend.
No, it was a great weekend for me.
The weather's been great.
Oh, it's been, I mean, look, I'm in a good state of mind. I'm in a good place. I know that you're probably going to take me into places that will diminish that somewhat over the course of this week. But I'm starting from a really good place, so you're going to really have to chip away to get me down in the dumps by Friday. And if you do, good on you. You did what you came to do. I know that's the purpose of you on this show.
Well, if you're happy, that's not going to cut it.
Another good week in the Beehive. We got Chris sad by Friday. Now we're finally on the same level.
All right, here we go. There's a lot going on in the world. We're going to talk about it. Here's Today in the Beehive. It is not easy to be a prince and princess in the age of 2021. We had Harry and Meghan. They had a bombshell interview last night with Oprah on CBS News. Okay, you would think like, all right. Everyone who just heard this is like, all right. I don't need to hear anymore. But guess what you do? Because the top story on CNN, I mean, there's stimulus packages going through. We're still in the middle of a ravaging pandemic. There's terrible things happening all around the world. Important journalism that needs to be done. What's the top story on CNN.com today? Fallout from Harry and Meghan's bombshell interview. That's the state of the media in today's day and age. The fallout from Harry and Meghan's bomb. Listen, look at these headlines. We got Timeline. Sign up for our royal newsletter. UK media tabloids hit back. Live updates. Here are the biggest revelations. Live updates. The interview aired yesterday. Is this a bigger crisis for the monarchy than the Diana scandal? Devastating. CNN's Quest reacts to interview. Highlights from the interview. Opinion. Harry and Meghan expose palace hypocrisy. Lots going on.
I didn't understand
on
anything
CNN.
You said.
CNN.com. You know about Harry and Meghan.
Well, yeah, I know of them now, but I don't know what's going on.
You know Harry.
I know Harry. I haven't met Meghan. It's just a thing. It's not because I'm sexist.
Harry.
I've just never ran into her around the palace. It's a big place.
Harry and Meghan have exposed palace hypocrisy. All right, before we get, we're going to dive deep on this interview for Today in the Beehive.
Oh, boy.
We're deep. We're going deep.
Oh, boy.
But first, let me tell you something. This is a report from the Wall Street Journal. CBS paid a license fee of between $7 million and $9 million for the rights to air Oprah Winfrey's interview with Prince Harry and the Duchess of Sussex, according to people familiar with the pact.
It sounds worth it if that's all anybody's talking about everywhere on planet Earth, right? That seems like a small price to pay.
$7 million? $7 to $9 million?
If I had $7 million I mean, I'd probably spend it on an interview with Prince Harry and Meghan. Wouldn't you? What would you spend it on?
I'd spend it on that. Why didn't they come to the Beehive?
I love that I have $7 million extra spare change suddenly in my account. I'm like, I got to get Harry and Meghan over here.
You know what? We could have aired that on the Beehive.
We could have, yeah. I mean, our bidding would be a little less enthusiastic.
You want $20?
From a financial standpoint, but we'd make up for it emotionally. You know, I would sell stuff. Okay.
We'll give you $20 and a half drunk Coke Zero.
It would be like a KSL barter where we go, look, we'll give you this yellow couch right here. We're going to give you a purple chair. I can trade you some old golf clubs and $20. Is that a fair trade?
But before you take the couch, you got to sit in it because we don't have another couch for you to do the interview in. So
you take that after the interview's over. That's signing the contract. Don't ask us. That's a lawyer thing.
They come on, this is the place with Clint Betts. Well, so.
So it's hard being a prince and princess in 2021, huh? That's your prodding point. Actually, the more I hear about it, I think that'd be good.
All right, so this is CNN's top story right now. I'm going to read part of it, and we're going to discuss it because it's intense. Meghan and Harry. Last night, CBS, Oprah Winfrey, she made $9 million to sit down and do this. All right, here we go. Meghan, Duchess of Sussex, said in a bombshell interview with Oprah Winfrey that her life as a British royal was so isolating and lonely at one point she didn't want to be alive anymore. A stunning admission, likely to rock the foundations of the centuries-old institution. Rock it.
Why would it rock it? I don't understand that
earthquake.
At all.
Really, an earthquake.
If somebody came to me and was just like, I've been isolated and I'm feeling a little bit lonely, I'd just be like, yeah, okay.
Welcome
to the
welcome
world.
Welcome to life.
Welcome to the world there, pal.
Candy world.
Go outside. Hang out with some friends. What do you want from me?
What do you think? It's all rainbows and roses
out
there?
I can't go in there and tell you to like get a friend. Okay?
No, just
go.
I mean, that's not cool that she was isolated and lonely.
No,
right?
It's not cool. The main point is, how is that a bombshell? That's everybody.
Oh, it's going to rock it. It's going to rock the Buckingham Palace.
Everybody's watching at Buckingham. What? She told me that she was my friend.
You've got to be kidding me. She was always so cheery.
Every time I brought her pancakes, she just gave me a big, warm smile.
In her first public comment since she and her husband, Prince Harry, announced their plans to step back from senior roles in the British royal family, Meghan described herself as the victim of an image-obsessed Buckingham Palace, which weighed in on everything from how dark her son's Archie skin color would be to how often she went to lunch with friends.
What? What are you talking about? Keep going.
Listen, I'm just reading it.
Okay.
The TV special was highly anticipated because Harry and Meghan are now allowed to speak more freely about the royal family due to their effective split from the palace.
Oh, so they're coming on court. That's why it's shaking everybody to their foundations.
And this sentence is on its own. It's its own paragraph. And the couple did not hold back.
They haven't. Not based on the stats I've heard so far.
Bum, bum, bum. Meghan began the interview speaking with Winfrey one-on-one outdoors in sun-drenched Southern California, where she and Harry now live.
What are you talking about?
Sun-drenched Southern California.
What are you talking about? They're living... That sounds cool. You're walking around with Oprah.
Oh, let me be very
drenched
clear.
In sun. Just let drenched.
Let me be very clear about Harry and Meghan. They're doing fine financially.
Sun drenched.
If we're talking about financially,
they're doing okay still. Okay, that was my first.
They're doing fine.
I heard your intro and I said,
we're talking finances.
Prince and princess, they aren't doing well. Like they probably fallen on hard times. Maybe not a lot of money. Sounds like they're living in sun drenched California.
Sun drenched.
Walking around with Oprah, doing better than I would have expected based upon your intro.
They're doing unbelievable, if you ask me.
I'll be honest. They're doing a little better than you and I.
Meghan,
do you agree with that?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Meghan made several revelations about the royal couple's private lives, including that the two were married 3 days before their official wedding.
Are you kidding me?
And the second child they are expecting
Kay.
Is a girl.
The second one didn't rattle me. The first one shook me to my very foundation, okay? Because I have lived my own personal life. I've sat here for the last however many years and I've gone, look, I live in a world where there's a lot of falsehoods. At least I know the specific day that the royal couple got married on, and that keeps me warm at night, and I don't feel like everything is a falsehood. Now I'm learning that 3 days before, the day that I woke up early, you know, got my snacks and treats and tuned in for the pregame, dude, pregame.
3 days before the
And I
big
get ready,
wedding.
And then the big wedding day, and I'm watching everything. I'm reading the news. I'm going, oh, my gosh, wow, this is what true love looks like. This is amazing. Now I'm finding out They'd already been married.
3 days before?
3 days before. That's a hard revelation to take. If you told me you'd been married 3 days before you were actually married, oh my gosh, I went to your wedding.
Would you shrug?
No, I'd be like, that was the only truth I thought was in my life.
Is
that
if somebody told me, like, I've actually been married, we were married a while back, but thanks for coming to celebrate this a big. Yeah, all right.
If somebody told me 3 days ago they were married to me and I didn't know about it, I'd just be like, fine.
It's okay.
Keep walking. We get a tax break. Baller. What do you want from
me? Keep walking, though.
Keep walking. We're not betting tonight.
I'll see you April 15th when we file taxes.
I got a strict 3-year policy, even if we're married. Okay?
But the most powerful portions of the 2-hour interview came when Meghan discussed the difficulties of her life as a working royal. Meghan, an American former actress, said she was forced to suppress her outspoken nature and give up her personal freedom. She said she did not have access to her passport, driver's license, or keys after she joined the royal family, and they were only returned when the couple moved away. Meghan said the situation was exacerbated by often racist and outdated colonial undertones that repeatedly appeared in coverage of the couple in Britain's notoriously vitriolic press. Fighting back tears at one point, Meghan said the thoughts of suicide were incredibly difficult to bear, and she was reticent to share them with her husband, who lost his mother, Princess Diana, when he was a boy.
Oh, that's Princess Diana's son. The things you learn on this podcast.
What?
That's amazing. Wait, was she
what?
Was she royal before?
You don't know Harry? I thought you knew Harry.
Was she royal before she married him? Or was she a commoner? She was a commoner.
She's a commoner.
Cool. This is a good story,
she's
then.
She's a commoner, like multi-million dollar
actress. She's a common multi-million dollar actress. Just a run of the mill.
Just like you and mine.
Just like you and me. It's amazing. Okay, so she's sad. I don't like that.
All right, so Harry said that he was pushed to discuss the issue with the royal family. He told Winfrey he believed there were many opportunities for the palace to show some public support in the face of continued abuse in the press, yet no one from my family ever said anything that hurts.
When they refer to the palace, are they just talking about his family? Or is that like the government
structure?
That's
I'm kind of
confused there. Okay.
Yeah.
Or is it the palace itself, like this stone structure that they live in? And they want the palace to come out, you know, make a statement. Open the drawbridge.
They'll tell you that actually we don't feel that way towards making a
message from the queen.
That'd be cool, dude. I wish America had royalty. I really do.
They said, I myself was trapped as well. This is Harry. I didn't see a way out. I was trapped, but I didn't know I was trapped. That's Henry. Harry.
Henry's not Diana's son.
Harry.
So he was trapped, but he wasn't aware of it till post-trapping. A little Stockholm syndrome, maybe.
Stockholm. Meghan said she felt she was a victim of character assassination in the British media and the machinations of the palace, which valued how it's perceived more than her, her husband, and her child's well-being. She also said that when she was pregnant with her son Archie, she was told he wouldn't be made a prince and thus wouldn't receive security.
Oh, you just... I don't get it. I don't get how it works. So a prince and a princess have a son. I thought that's a prince now. But you get to choose. It's like he's not a prince at this point.
No,
I don't really understand how that works.
I don't.
You don't understand the royal inner workings? What are you even doing, dude?
Honestly, I think Archie's better off not being a prince.
It sounds like, based on this interview, you'd be much happier not being a prince. If he just went out into the common world, you know, like a common dude who's worth hundreds of millions of dollars, it sounds like he'd live a better life.
Meghan said it was particularly difficult putting on a happy face while suffering in silence.
Mm.
She recounted one particular evening at Royal Albert Hall with her husband, while the two were sitting together in the royal box.
Where Bob Dylan played just for them, no one else in the crowd.
Every time that those lights went down, I was just weeping and he was gripping my hand. When the lights went back on, Meghan said he'd just have to be on again. The interview has sparked something of a public relations battle between the Sussexes.
Okay. You could sense my question, but
what does that mean? And allies of Buckingham Palace. On Tuesday, following the release of promotional clips in advance of the interview, the Times of London published an article that alleged Meghan bullied several staff members. Bullied!
Sent back the pancakes.
The story cited unnamed royal aides, saying a complaint in 2018 claimed the Duchess drove out two personal assistants from her Kensington Palace household and undermined the confidence of a third staff member.
What's happening? Wait, I need to go back to Royal Albert Hall. So they're watching a show there in a private box?
And she's crying.
No, no, no. They would watch the show when the lights are on and like had a good time. They're like, this is a great concert. And then when the curtain would go down and it'd be in darkness, just and then for a couple minutes you're like, it's okay, it's fine. Then the curtains come back up. Oh, we're good. We're good to go. That's an incredible skill, actually.
How did she undermine the confidence of a staff member?
Well,
like, hey, you freaking suck. I know you think you're all that now, but wait.
Some maid comes in to like dust the thing. She's like, I just got to let you know, you're bad at that. This place has been dusty for quite some time. You're not doing your job well.
Meghan discussed rumors of a dispute with Kate, Duchess of Cambridge, the wife of Prince William.
How do the duchesses work? I need all this stuff explained. What's a duchess versus a princess?
Meghan said reports she made Kate cry over dresses of flower girls at her wedding were untrue, and it was, in fact, the Duchess of Sussex who cried. There was no confrontation.
That's a great one. This is not the person who cried. That's the person who cried.
She declined to discuss the incident further because Kate had apologized to her. I don't think it's fair to her to get into the details of that.
Yeah, I mean, we got to draw a line somewhere, you know.
This is good. Harry said the decision to step back has had financial consequences.
Oh, no.
They were cut off by the palace in early 2020.
No! Their allowance is gone? The palace allowance?
And affected his relationship with his family. He said his father, Prince Charles, who is next in line to the throne, briefly stopped taking his calls.
Yeah.
I feel very let down because he's been through something similar. He knows what pain feels like, and Archie is his grandson.
I mean, I know what pain feels like, you know.
They signed like a huge deal with Netflix, like in the $200 to $300 million.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's not as much money as they would have had if you topped that off with an allowance from the palace, you know?
They're in sun-drenched Southern California.
Sun-drenched isn't a good term.
We're in cloud-drenched Salem, Utah right now.
Where it is in mopey Salem. Oh, it's pretty
windy
today.
You see any princesses around here?
Well, it's pretty windy today because there's a storm that's blowing in a little bit for tonight. We don't have the ability to sit around in a bunch of sun-drenched areas every day, okay? Mm-hmm. Are our allowances taken away? Yes, they are. Mm-hmm. You know, do you see me running over to the Daily Herald and going, hey, I got to correct the record. I didn't make Kelly cry, our producer. I made Clint cry. He's the co-host. And the lights go down. You're over there. Turns on. The show comes on. You're fine.
I expected to be happy always.
So, like, there's a pandemic, and I didn't get to go around anybody, and I felt isolated.
I thought for sure I'd always be happy, but right now I don't feel that way.
This is rude to say, because everybody has gone through it, and a lot of people are still going through it, depending on where you live, because of the pandemic. I just can't hear any more of the, like, I'm isolated stories because of the pandemic. I know, everybody is. It's like somebody coming out into the news and saying, I'm breathing air today. And I go, yeah, everybody on earth is breathing air today. Mm-hmm. That's something that doesn't need to be stated at this point. You know,
I will say that life is hard. Life is sad.
Life is hard and life is sad. Again, that's fine. That's fine. You can say all those things. I don't
and
need
I'm
to hear
fine.
That
if you
specific
tell me,
detail.
That's fine. If you want to go, I don't know, if you want to like go talk to Oprah in sun-drenched Southern California and be like, yeah, life is pretty sad.
If I sign a big pact, it's going to be with the Daily Herald, and I'm going to spill all the beans. Okay. And our pact will be worth at least $10.
So, in local news from ABC4, a library has rewarded children with free burgers.
That's cool. I like that.
And then the other big story is a man allegedly broke into an apartment, threatened a person with a machete in Iron County.
Okay, don't do that. Real quick on the grade school thing. When I was a young lad in Provo, they had a reading program where if you read X amount of books, you got a personal pan pizza from Pizza Hut. And truly, it was the greatest motivating factor to get me into reading, which I now love reading. And I think it's a great benefit for anybody to get into. Every school should have this system. You go, you know what? Read 3 Bernstein Bears books, and we'll take you out to Crown Burger and buy you the lowest price cheeseburger. No, not cheese, hamburger. We got to save some money with the kids. The main point is it's a great motivator. Imagine if they came to you right now and said, Clint, if you read 3 Bernstein Bears novels, we're going to buy you a 6-pack of Coke Zero.
Ooh, okay.
You'd get off air right now. You'd end the show. you'd settle down with Mama Bear and Papa Bear and Sister Bear. Oh.
First of all, I hated that setup. Like, when I was a kid, I was super lonely. Well, who were my companions? Books.
When I was 4 and 6 and that's eight so and 10, I didn't have any friends.
It was books
I
that was, got me through life.
I was isolated, okay? It was pre-pandemic. I just sat at home and I said, where are all the kids? Why does anybody want me to play basketball with them? Mm-hmm. And what did I turn to? I turned to the Bernstein Bears. Mama Bear, Papa Bear, Brother Bear, Sister Bear. There's
Goldilocks
4 of them.
Goldilocks would come.
Goldilocks would come. And, oh my gosh, where's the honey gone? Oh, it's in the tree. Brother Bear hit it again. Those are the friends that you make when a personal pan pizza is the carrot that you dangle. Mm-hmm. You know. So I'd go and I'd grab the pizza and then I'd eat the pizza reading more. And that's how I learned to live in the world where you're isolated. And I never turned into a royal member. Mm. See, if I hadn't done that, I'd probably be in a palace somewhere right now, giving a tell-all interview. Like,
you know, I'd rather be in sun-drenched Southern California, personally, than the palace. I really would.
I can't wait till it's sun-drenched.
It's sun-drenched, according to CNN. Sun-drenched. That's cool. All right, we need to talk about some sports. Let's go to No Baller.
So, Clint, this weekend was a good recharge for me because, as we talked about, the NBA All-Star Game and its associated festivities were over this weekend, which I refuse to participate in. You know me. I'm not a moral person. I don't take almost any moral stances. I think the only moral stance I have in my entire life is that I am morally opposed to any all-star type game or any of the surrounding hoopla, right? So I won't watch the Pro Bowl. I'm not going to tune into the NHL All-Star game, the NBA. I'm not going to pay attention. I don't want to hear about it. Nothing of this stuff, okay? So this weekend, it's a good reach. It's a good reset. It's the middle of the season. I've been grinding out my bets, you know, and I'm going, okay, I can play golf all time. I don't have to watch really much anything. I'll catch the Avalanche when they play. And then other than that, you know, I got some spare time, some free time. I can read a few books, dude.
Oh, my God.
I said, so let me tell
when
you.
When I get lonely out on the golf course, I pull out a book. And it's the books that really get me through. It's the words. It's the words of Hemingway when Hemingway describes things, the sunsets. And
book people. I got to defend book people real fast. Book people are cool. They're my kindred spirits, you know.
We're going to talk to a book person after this segment.
That's why I'm setting it up. Everybody dives into books for various reasons. You talk to a person who actually writes books. The main point is books are cool. But that's not what this segment is about. Okay, this is not a book segment. Mm-hmm. We will launch that starting next week. Mm-hmm. It's called Books with Chris. Mm-hmm. And I just talk about the Bernstein
Bears.
That'd
be cool. I'd like that.
So I'm just kind of like, I save a bunch of sports articles in Pocket and on The Athletic, and sometimes I get bogged down because I'm reading other things and golfing and that kind of stuff. So now I have some reading time this week, and I go, sweet, I can catch up on all these things. So I'm reading through this stuff, you know. Okay, cool. This is going well. And like, I was reading about just kind of mid-season Jazz recaps, essentially. Like, okay, you know, they're 27-9. Here's where they stand. Offense doing this. Three-point shooting through the roof. Okay, what do we think the second half of the season is going to be like? All that kind of stuff. And so then I was reading more, and I was just kind of like thinking about the Jazz in general. Because for some reason, I came across some article that mentioned the year that Stockton and Malone were in the All-Star game, and they like shared the MVP, right? And I was thinking about Karl Malone, which the purpose of the segment is mainly I just have two specific questions that I want to ask, right? And the first one dealt with Karl Malone, because Karl Malone, credible basketball player, right? Anybody who grew up in that area.
The greatest of all time. Yeah.
You think he's the GOAT? Even better.
Well, I think either Malone's the greatest of all time or Stockton's
Hornacek,
the greatest of all
Hornacek.
Time. I mean, it's a tough call. Like, who are you going to pick? And then Hornacek, second greatest. I mean, he's better than Scottie Pippen.
Well, I mean, Horny's the best shooter ever, easily better than
Horn
Steph
Dog?
Curry. Horn Dog.
Who are you going to put up against Horn Dog?
Really?
Steph?
Really quick aside, Jeff Hornacek, as The Last Dance, the 10-part documentary was airing over the summer on Michael Jordan. And then now it's on Netflix, you can watch it. As that was going on, for some reason, Jeff Hornacek made like a miniature documentary about what it was like to guard Jordan.
Hell
which Hornacek, not that anybody did it successfully, but imagine going to like one of the worst defenders to play against Michael Jordan and being like, so how did you guard him? And he's like, I just stood there.
He just dropped 35, 40, and 9.
I was flat-footed and he'd run around me. This is embarrassing. Why am I on a documentary doing this? So I'm thinking about that era of Jazz basketball because of the All-Star stuff that they're talking about with Malone. And I can't get over. This is the first question I have to ask you. Because it's less prominent in present-day sports. But like, The style from the past, even, you know, 25, 30, 40 years ago, especially in basketball, everybody had their signature thing, which is sweet. You know, like Jordan's Jumpman is the most iconic, him spreading the legs as he's dunking, the tongues out. Truly, like, really, really, really cool. And you can just show that image and everybody goes, okay, we know exactly what this is. This is what it is. And you had a bunch of other players who they have their own thing, you know. And so Karl Malone, not a flashy star, but like an actual star, just the grinded out, I'm going to get 30 and
lunch pail.
I'm going to get 30 and 13. I'm going to get on the block. I'm going to hit a bunch of 15-foot fadeaways. I'm going to mumble stuff at the free throw line. I'll elbow somebody in the face every few games. Just let them know that, like, if you get up too close on me, I'm just going to blast you, right? Karl Malone, he gets swept up in this, and he's like, I got to match. I got to find, like, what my thing is. And here's the question I want to ask. How did Karl Malone come up with the hammer dunk is his actual signature play? Because I assume Karl Malone has friends or like management or even just an agent or something, you know, like an inner circle. And if I'm in an inner circle and my star player comes to me and goes, dude, if you people are going crazy for this Jordan Jumpman thing, I got to find my own signature play. What do you guys think it should be? And somebody over there goes, you know, be cool is if when you dunk, you just put your hand behind your head, you know, and they go, that looks, I'm picturing that in my mind. That looks sweet. That's so cool. And then everybody just passes it off and he goes, okay, I'll start doing that game. So Karl Malone, he'd get a breakaway dunk and he'd run up, just a normal dunk. It wasn't even like a tomahawk or anything. You just go run up, dunk, put the hand behind the head and dunk it.
I loved it. I think it was so cool.
Here's the best part about
it. I think it was so cool.
Here's the part about it that's kind of cool. Because of that era and because we're like, everybody has to have their signature play, it almost didn't matter what it was because I remember when I was a kid. You know,
you're the hammer dunk was so
dude,
cool.
Dude, you'd go play on the Little Tykes hoop with your friends. You'd pretend to be Jordan.
First thing I'd do.
You'd hammer dunk.
Hammer dunk.
I'd read 3 Bernstein Bears novels, cash in on the pizza, then with a full belly, go out and practice hammer dunk. Boom, boom, hand behind the head.
That's cool.
Don't you think, though, like if you and I were in an inner circle, let's just say it's you and I, and then we have Karl Malone's the player who we're with. We could immediately come up with better stuff than that.
I don't think
you
I don't, could.
You don't think so?
I don't think I could.
So you truly do love the hammer dunk.
I really do think the hammer dunk is cool. I think it's way funny, first of all. I think it's humorous. And I think it's athletic. It's hard to do that. Like, while dunking, you gotta put one hand in the back.
Well, you have a bad shoulder. That's not fair.
Ow!
The range of motion to get it, like, passed back here, where he'd go back.
He'd go back.
To get it back there
it's
is
athletic.
Hard.
It's athletic.
This is what I think Malone should have leaned into, though, because if you fast forward a little bit further to the very end of Malone's career, Tim Duncan comes into the league, right? Tim Duncan, who's like the most robotic superstar in the history of robots and superstars. And Tim Duncan, he had that inkling in him. He goes, I need my iconic thing. And he leaned into what he is, which is a robot. And so Tim Duncan's truly iconic thing is he hit a 12-foot elbow jumper off the glass.
Bank shot.
And he'd bank it in and everybody's like, oh, dude. What a banking. And I'm sure that there are tons of people. We all played basketball growing up. Mm-hmm. Anytime you'd hit that jumper, what would everybody say? Oh, Timmy D. Imagine if Karl Malone, here's what I think Karl Malone should have done. Instead of choosing the hammer dunk, you know what the actual thing that I associate with Karl Malone in my mind? When Karl Malone would grab a rebound and he'd just start doing the like NBA Jam twist where he'd go, and he'd throw his elbows at everybody. And if you were anywhere near him, he'd elbow you right in the head and knock you out. And that was his thing. Like, imagine if Karl Malone's thing was just this, doing the back and forth. Anybody comes close, bam, right in your nose.
Here's what I don't like. The Jazz have gotten a lot of disrespect over the past
from
week.
The media.
That's why I'm wearing the Stockton jersey.
Yeah. You're dressed for success today.
I do not like the disrespect. This is me counteracting the media's narrative about Utah and the Jazz. This is me going at them.
Wait, you're counteracting the disrespect by wearing a Jazz hat and a Jazz jersey?
I'm respecting
with a long sleeve undershirt underneath the jersey? That's how you're counteracting.
I'm not going to show everything.
I love that Charles Barkley's sitting inside the NBA studio somewhere and he's like, somebody's firing back at me. There's a guy in Utah.
Did Charles go after Malone? Because Malone is better than Charles. Screw you, Charles.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the whole thing.
All right. So what I don't like is, you know, there's the two Jazz players got picked last. Donovan and
Rudy.
Disrespect. Super disrespectful. We got Conley in, but just because Booker couldn't play. Great. How good is that?
We're
3 All-Stars.
I think that. So first of all, everybody needs to remember, whenever you use All-Star games as a measuring stick for somebody, just remember that like 6 people are always injured and they invite Bozo, Magoo, and this or that. Like, Conley's 10th down the list of people who should have been in the All-Star game and then made it, which I'm not dissing on Mike Conley. The main point is we now have 30 All-Stars every year where it's like, yeah, that's an All-Star when the team should be like 8 people.
I think Jordan Clarkson and Bogey should have been it as well.
I think
we should have had 5. I really think it should have just been the Jazz versus everyone else. I think we would have won, too.
The better idea is, if you really wanted to make the skills competition sweet, you get the people who would actually be funny to like test their skills. You get George Niang out there running around the gorgeous court like trying George. To dribble through traffic cones.
He's gorgeous.
Imagine that, though. Imagine you got 3 Zions Bank tellers on one side running through cones, and George Niang has to do it on his side. And like stop and start. Just have George Niang run ladders. I'd watch that. I'm not even joking.
He's so gorgeous. Gorgeous George?
That much, just like man running there, stopping on a dime, running back, running
that
back.
That much beef going up and down the court.
It'd be great. The other thing that freaks me out about that era, which is the question that I want to ask to you. Back in the day, it was a much more modest time. You're still in the modesty phase with your own jersey. You
modest
wear stuff underneath.
Modest is hottest, Chris.
Modest is hottest, as this state knows. However, back in a time where we supposedly were like more into modesty, the number one choice of all NBA players, including John Stockton, his iconic thing was just wearing these perverse shorts that literally showed everything. We could see anything.
It's pretty bad A. I won't say the full word, but it's pretty bad A.
What John Stockton, his iconic thing is that he wore incredibly short shorts.
They all did.
In an era where everybody just wore like
Bird
huge.
Did, Magic did. Jordan's the one who started the long shorts.
I know, but it was in society. Everybody wore huge pants. And like billowy shirts, like these huge folds, like you were wearing a tent almost. And for some reason, when they're going to play basketball, we're like, oh yeah, we just want like a bunch of half naked dudes. They're actually like 4/5 naked. They're just running around playing basketball. Nobody batted an eye. I find that very strange. Like now we're cycling back to short shorts are now more popular amongst
way
the up and coming
cool,
crowd,
think.
You know? Well, okay.
I think it is modest.
You do think it's modest. Explain.
Yeah. If you're going to wear shorts, I don't want to see your knees. I want to see the thigh.
Okay, so it's about where the eye is drawn.
Yeah, I want to go straight to the thigh.
So I like that as a slogan for modesty. Mm-hmm. It's not how much you show, it's where you draw the eye, mm-hmm. You know?
Where you draw the eye. I don't want to see a knee.
Is there anything sexual about the mid-thigh? No, not at all. What have you ever done with a mid-thigh that's sexual? A kneecap, however. I mean, there's some stuff on your OnlyFans account that involves knees that, I mean, you got to, that's the premium. That's a primo content.
It's a little too much. It really is.
Do you think we're going to go back to a time where, not go back to a time, but just with the fashion cycles, do you think we're going to get to a point where like we go away from the Fab Five long baggy shorts and now we're to the point where it's like, oh yeah, everybody wears Stockton style shorts again? Or do you just think that's past?
I'm not sure. I think we underestimate Michael Jordan's influence on the league. I think it's really his league still to this day, and he defines.
I don't think anybody underestimates that.
So if Jordan says it's okay, then they'll all do it.
Well, now people are growing out hair. They're going against Jordan's bald, because that was a huge thing for like 20 years post-Jordan. Mm. But now they're growing their hair out, you know? You can get some hair. You got a nice do.
I bet Jordan's okay.
Maybe the short shorts are back.
Because Dennis Rodman had crazy hair, and he was fine.
The only thing that nobody could copy because they just didn't know how to do it, they're like, how do we do that weird Jordan mustache that he's always had? And why did he choose that as his main physical feature? I associate that more than I do the bald head. I'm just like, why does he always have that weird mustache? But you'd probably be a good person to speak to.
You know what's
about
weird?
That.
I agree with you on the All-Star game. I hate that the Major League Baseball, the winner of the All-Star game gets home field advantage
garbage.
In the World Series. That league, that's insane. That makes no sense at all. Why is that a thing? That's such a big deal. Home field in the World Series. Oh my goodness, and they had this random exhibition game that means nothing decides that. I hate that. But NBA All-Star game, it doesn't mean anything.
Correct.
And when I was a kid, I loved the NBA All-Star game. Isn't that weird? I loved it. And now I, you know, could take it or leave it. But my son, who's way into basketball now, loves it. And he, you know.
Oh, great.
So we're watching it last night.
Oh my gosh.
I watched it last
great.
Night. It's way different now. They like it's like who's winning the quarters. It's kind of sucks, actually.
Of course it sucks. I will say, this is the last thing I'll say on the subject. Not to toot my own horn, even as a lad, I was a moral being. And I said, I'm not participating in the All-Star
You didn't like
game.
It even as a kid?
No, no.
All the big stars?
Dude, I was a no-nonsense child.
Oh, my God.
I went to the stats. I went to the numbers. And I said, I sat down with my dad, and that's the memory I have. We watched the All-Star
You didn't
game
watch
together.
The dunk contest?
No, no, no.
3-point shootout?
No, no.
Which Steph Curry won last night, but
I
didn't even know
I was about the X's and O's, the game.
right. Well, we talked to someone really amazing. I really enjoyed this conversation.
We're talking, yes, books.
We're talking books with Dr. Karen Anderson. But first, a word from our sponsor, Rags. I'm here with Dr. Karen Anderson, who was raised primarily in Alpine, Utah, coming of age in a high season of Cold War politics, Watergate, the Federal Wilderness Act, the Gilmore and Bundy sagas, shag hairstyles, local vilification of the Equal Rights Amendment, and hamburger casseroles. She graduated from Utah State University in 1984, completed a master's degree in English from Brigham Young University in 1987, and a PhD in creative writing from the University of Utah in 2003. Dr. Anderson, a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Anderson, you wrote a book called Before Us, Like a Land of Dreams. It was published in 2019. It's published by Torrey House Press, which is out of Salt Lake City, actually. Tell us about that book. What led to you writing that, and what was the ultimate premise of it?
What led me to write that? Six generations of Mormon ancestry, most likely, certainly living in the West and working to come to terms with that. Especially as I hand that legacy down to my children who are not raised in the tradition that I was. And I guess that would be true as well. I think I wrote it in many ways for my students who at Utah Valley University, who are sometimes struggling with their own legacies and relationships to place and culture and heritage in ways that continue to matter to them.
You've been a professor at Utah Valley University for almost 30 years now. I went to Utah Valley University. I studied journalism in the communications department. But how has that experience been like for you? Teaching at Utah Valley University, what's that been like?
Wow. That's been like quite a few things over a 30-year span. I was lucky enough to get a job there when it was still UVCC. I think I was hired there the last year that we were UVCC, and then we jumped over up to UVA State College status, and then the school pretty rapidly spun itself up into university status. So I feel like I've had a lot of careers at UVU. First as a very young mother who just needed a job and needed to pay for, I don't know, jammies and groceries. Certainly when I was hired there, maybe like quite a few of us, we kind of thought we were doing the institution a favor, and we quickly figure out that we're incredibly lucky to be working there and to be in that environment and to be among those students. So I feel like it's the luckiest thing that I ever dropped myself into as a grown up. I feel like that's probably the best, just pure gift of my adult life, was landing that job when I was young and before I understood really what kind of meaning it would hold for me.
UVU really is a remarkable place. It's a remarkable place as you think about who that student body is. It's so close to BYU. Like when I was going there, I was working. I think I had two jobs. I had a small little family, and it seemed like everyone who I was classmates with and going to school was in the same boat. Like school was something that we were doing on top of something else, which I don't think is a super common thing for a lot of university students, right? Is to be, you know, it's almost like we were going at nights, we were going at weekends, we were doing all that type of stuff. It just seems like the student body there is very gritty, hardworking, motivated. Does all that make sense? I mean, you would know this far better than I do. What is your experience of that?
Oh, I'm right with you on that. I I think we're kind of in a national crisis, of course, regarding you know, what education is for, what its genuine value is. You know, these have been questions my whole career, and probably were questions for me when I was an undergraduate. But UVU has had the right mix for me and my temperament and my values, and it's probably developed a lot of my temperament and values. I love the hard work ethic of my students. I especially love the way so many of my students come to the classroom with no idea what they're capable of. They're very good at their jobs in the real world. Many of them go home to families, children. Many of them are certainly interested in the meaningful value of a college education, but they would like to get out of there and make a better living and meet the market. To me, I don't know. I think the confusion of that has kept UVU in some ways a little bit confused about its identity and purposes. And I think also that confusion has created a really dynamic, sort of exciting, ongoing energy that really feeds the relationship between the professors and the students, students and students. You know, I've seen a lot of political changes at UVU, and a lot of political changes in, I don't know, again, the state and the nation in terms of what we think education is about. But what stayed consistent at UVU is once we're in the classroom, that's our space and it belongs to us. And the chemistry in the classroom has been just remarkable. And I just feel like my students have kept me interested in the planet, you know, kept me interested in Utah Valley and in what that place has come to me as opposed to maybe what it was when I was growing up. So I couldn't feel luckier and happier with what my career has handed me. And it was a lot of luck, and it was a lot of figure out what to do at certain points of my own crises in my own life. So I feel like my lifespan has really, I don't know, moved with my students in lots of ways.
I love the way you phrase that around the term confusion. That sparked something in me, like it was confusing going to UVU. And I never thought of it in those terms until you said that, because, you know, I'm working, I've got a family, like, why am I doing this too? I feel like I should be doing this, and this is important, and I really enjoyed being there. And but it was so confusing. Beautiful way to put that.
Yeah, you know, maybe sort of a creative confusion at its best. I think you can go to a place like UVU and, I don't know, check the boxes and get your degree and get the advancement that your boss promised you if you go get a college degree. And that's probably valuable. I'm a huge fan of making a living. I'm a really big fan of making a paycheck, and especially if you can make it doing something you care a little bit about, because it's, you know, hard enough. But that confusion also means that so many times I've seen my students lean in with certain readings or certain kinds of conversations, ask questions that really does reflect an honest and sincere sense of confusion that is probably the mode we should be in when we're sitting in a college classroom. There's a sincerity, and there's a bit of a bewilderment. There's also, of course, that Utah Valley certainty that they know, that many of my students know the actual truth outside and beyond the classroom. But even that means, you know, students wonder what that means as they bring it to other kinds of conversations. And they're interested. I mean, they care about it, and it matters. And I don't know, it feels like a place where education matters very individually to every single student, and they have to decide what it means to them. And most of them are up for the task.
I think that's beautifully put. Beautifully put. You're also working, I have a note here that you're working on an anthology of essays, and poetry by Mormon or Mormon adjacent writers
focused on our sometimes complex relationships to land and environment. The collection is titled Blossom as the Cliff Rose, Mormon Legacies in the Beckoning Wild. Tell me about that project. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I probably have quite a bit to say about it. I feel strange with that title. I guess that's where my entire sort of academic and personal and Utah Valley life history all sort of collide. I formally left the Mormon Church years ago. I live in Salt Lake City and I raised my kids distinctively and, you know, with a commitment to live without the religion and to break that sort of tradition of faith. I guess it's taken me a lot of years to realize that, you know, you leave a religion, you don't leave a culture, you don't leave a history, you don't leave a people necessarily. And maybe that's especially true because I teach at a secular university in my home valley. I understand its cultural collisions and cultural questions, at least to a certain point. So sometimes I feel like I keep getting dragged back into that identity. And when Kirsten Johanna Allen, the editor-in-chief of Torrey House Press, asked me and Danielle Dubrowski to consider putting together an anthology like this, I kind of bucked at it. I wasn't sure that I was ready to put myself so unapologetically, I don't know, something to a book with that kind of a title and that kind of a project. But again, UVU really feeds into this. I've been teaching creative writing at UVU for a long time. I've seen so many students wrestle to claim their own heritage, to understand their relationship to their sort of family or cultural religion when they don't live it in quite the same ways. A lot of my writers are really stymied by the sense that they don't deserve to write about their own heritage or their own background or their own culture in their own home because they aren't living it in the ways that their home people expect them to. So there's a certain kind of shock of voicelessness for a lot of young writers who are really trying to find identity routes that go beyond the religion. And that seems to be a kind of particular energy for the writers, a lot of our writers at UVU. So part of what makes me really happy about this collection is we have 11 either faculty or former students or people who have been affiliated with UVU at certain points who have written beautiful essays, really gorgeous essays that are part of this collection. I'll show it to you. Here's at least the
I love the cover. That's great.
Copy right now. Yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it? And we really have a remarkable collection of writers. And that, so I think I mentioned in our kind of written discussion about this, there's as far as Danielle and I can trace it, this is the first anthology or collection that really focuses on Mormon culture and Mormon adjacent writers that doesn't ask one camp or another to speak. This is, if you have some kind of meaningful connection to Mormon heritage, to the Mormon faith, the Mormon religion, whatever it is, our question was, how did that guide you or lead you or send you on some kind of path that ground you in place and a commitment to the environment? And the response was stunning. The response is just absolutely beautiful. The range of essays and the range of poetry that we have here, from believers, non-believers, committed apostates, queer and straight writers, I'm especially grateful and happy that we have Native American writers who've contributed. It's actually very strange to see the impact of very distinct groups of people who have claimed or have some kind of connection to the Mormon Church write stories that actually speak in the same space. I realize that Native American and Anglo writers tend to write in different spaces or write to each other. And these essays don't necessarily write directly to one another, but they speak together and sort of speak from the same position. And the variety is what I I don't know, something I've seen at UVU for years and years. How many voices, how much is still untapped in terms of at least Mormon, Western, enculturated writing? And that, so it's a, I'm really excited about it. It's coming out in June. I hope everyone will track down Tori House's website. I love what Tori House is doing. They're a remarkable group of editors. They produce remarkable books that are founded in the West, and mostly in the Great Basin West. And a lot of us writers have been looking for that kind of collection and that kind of venue and that kind of community for a long time. So it's a pleasure to work with them. So it's a very secular book, really designed to be a collection that taps into a cultural pocket of the American West, especially contemporary American West. And it's amazing what comes up out of it. So gratifying, really gratifying project.
You said something fascinating in there that I'd love to go a little bit deeper on. And I'm just paraphrasing what you said, but you said something around like when you're working with your students, they often don't feel like they have the right to write about their heritage. Or you didn't use this word, but I think about this word a lot, particularly on you know, what we do on the entrepreneurial side of things, and this idea of permission. And this idea that folks are looking for permission when in fact they don't really need it. How do you think about that as it relates to writing?
I think we can't write until we give ourselves permission to our own content. And most of the time our content is fraught and very often painful, and a lot of times we're sick of it. And also, I think I have to help my classroom writers recall how much they love their own lives and families and heritage and peculiar ways they've been raised. There's a certain kind of love and distance, I think, that we have to learn as people who come from highly particular places. It's not something you can just jettison. It's not something that goes away. So I think a lot of our students, it might be one of the reasons why we like fantasy writing so much in sort of local Mormon Utah Valley-ish culture. There's kind of an escapist quality that I understand, but there's a moment where everybody's writing really just has to come home in some way or another. And you know, I guess I'll just be really straightforward, because I was raised so deeply, deeply inside of the Mormon culture and worked very hard to stay inside of it and part of it and speak for it in positive and meaningful ways. There were a lot of times that it just took me a long time to find the courage to write what I saw, what I understood, what I didn't understand, but could parse out and portray. And there is a moment where I think maybe one of the best purposes of a writing classroom is to give our students sanction and permission. A lot of our, you know, there are a lot of people carrying an awful lot of story, but again, in the culture I was raised in, it's a storytelling culture, it's a testimonial culture, it's a journal writing culture, but you really are trained to write the official story and represent everyone when you represent your experience. And that's a hard thing to lose. That's a very, very hard thing to sort of disengage. And, you know, for example, my queer students, I don't know, sort of as a category, a group of students or a group of people or writers who are more committed to family, family roles, love of home and love of place, deep identifications with the people they know, and yet have been, you know, almost completely silenced. Even if it's, yeah, we'll tolerate you and you can come home for dinner, or you're our favorite gay kid or whatever, it's still then tell our story and tell it positively and tell it happily. And I'm not saying we have to get all negative and cynical about it, but real life, real characters, real people are extremely complex. And this is a culture that wants simple, very clean, highly representative, and largely positive stories. And that's, you know, that hurts our writers until they can get past it.
Who are some of your favorite Utah writers?
Utah writers. You know, the first Utah-ish writer who really shook me to the core was Monita Brooks, historian. Of course, she wrote the definitive, at least the early, loyal and disloyal history of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Her voice was something I recognized instantly. I felt like I'd really kind of come home to her. There was, she had an ability to recognize the deep and terrible flaws of her own people and her own culture without losing her love and respect for who they were as human beings. So Juanita Brooks, I, in some ways I see my life as, at least my intellectual, academic, creative life as before Juanita Brooks and after Juanita Brooks. I still have a great deal of admiration for Virginia Sorensen, writing Born at the Turn of the Century in Manti, Utah. Her stories hold up in remarkable ways, again, just because she's such a so culturally astute. Right now, there is an incredible renaissance and flowering of, again, I guess I have to say Mormon adjacent writers, because I'm seeing a whole lot of freedom sort of opening up in those directions. So there's some just incredible stuff going on that we don't always recognize as Mormon. I think my favorite Utah Valley book, Mormon heritage book, Mormon kid growing up Mormon book right now is Michael Palmer's Baptizing the Dead and Other Jobs. Bahaun Press, Bauhaun, I believe. Anyone who's grown up in Utah Valley will recognize it in such lush ways, but it's written with a clear and beautiful voice. Love and cynicism really belongs to his generation. I think it'll continue to speak to my students for decades.
That's incredible. Thank you so much for coming on, Dr. Anderson. We got to have you on again, particularly when this book is officially released. We'll make sure that we push it out to all of our listeners and viewers in the Beehive community. I can't thank you, and I could talk to you forever about writing and what the work you're doing. So a real honor to have you on the show, Dr. Anderson.
Such a pleasure. Hope to talk to you again. I just discovered your show, and I really admire it.
Thank you so much.
Take it easy.
That was Dr. Karen Anderson, who I just found out was your professor.
Yeah, I had an incredible revelation while the interview came on. And in my defense, my college past was just, it was a Taco Bell-induced haze. You know, I don't remember a lot. It was hard for me to just wade through all the beefy five layers to remember what was going on. So before I actually majored in journalism, I was kind of this lost, rudderless soul. And I was like, you know, I like reading a lot, as I've said many times on this show already. Mm-hmm. And I go, oh, I'm going to try out some of these English classes. So one of the classes I took, it was a literary theory class. And so she came on and I was like, wait a second, Dr. Karen Anderson, that rings a bell a ton. And then I saw her and I'm like, oh yeah, I actually took a class from her. So little did we know, you interviewed her and I had her as a professor. She was a good professor.
Dr. Karen Anderson, a lovely, lovely, lovely interview with her. Really enjoyed it. We're going to have her back on. Check out her books and the various things that she's published. And now, why though?
Okay, it is Monday and it is why though. And as everybody knows who listens to why though, Monday is Country Music Monday.
Why do you say it like that? Kawaii, though.
Why?
It's like Kawhi Leonard.
Is everybody
like
listens
kawaii.
To Kawhi, though?
Kawhi, though.
Hey, I like Kawhi Leonard. Sue me, okay? Everybody who listens to Why, though? That's a little abbreviated version. Mm. Every Monday, we get country music song. We go, this genre of music, I don't know if it's the best, but it deserves further discussion. So Kelly Jensen, who is also our producer right now, she sends us a country music song. We discuss the lyrics on air. You have something ready for me. I don't know what it is, and I'm ready to go. So, Clint, give me the song. Give me the title. Give me the author, the name, everything.
All right. There's this very attractive man. His name's Sawyer Brown. Sawyer Brown.
It's a band. Even I know that.
Kelly is saying in our ear that it's a band, not a man.
I can now see them behind you, and I can attest to the attractiveness level.
So, there are very attractive men who are in a band titled Sawyer Brown. All of them attractive. In particular, the man in the middle, that little hat he's got going on, the fishing hat, that's cool.
I can't find one uglier person in the mix. Out of the five of them.
That's a group. That's an attractive group. They're called Sawyer Brown. They put out a song called Thank God for You. Thank God for You.
Wow, thank you.
Wow.
This sounds like it's going to have a good message.
Wow, isn't that nice?
I'm assuming Sawyer Brown is speaking directly to me.
Anybody ever said that for you, too?
If that guy in the bucket hat that people can see if they're watching on view, he came up to me and just said, Chris, thank God for you. I mean, that would change my life.
So of the band, I wonder which I like best. I think just from like a looks perspective. So the bucket hat, really good. He's got two necklaces. He's got the little, what do you call this? Soul patch. Soul but then patch. He's also got like a little scrub.
A soul patch and a chin goatee. It's a combo job.
That's fascinating. But the guy in the back left there. Wow. See, he's got a necklace. He's got a huge collar. Two huge collars going on.
I think the most interesting person is actually the second from the right. The guy who's dressed up in like a tan jacket in a gray Hanes shirt. And he looks like he's 40 years older than everyone else in the band. And he really is out of place.
He's just their dad.
Like that guy's like worried about what day to take the trash out on. Like, remember on Tuesday to wheel it out in the morning. And he's out with some sexy band, you know? How did he get in?
So Sawyer Brown is a band. It's not a person. Duh.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I whiffed on that one.
They put out a song called Thank God for You. Here's how it goes. Well, I've been called a self-made man. Girl, don't you believe it's true? I know exactly how lucky I am when I'm getting this close to you.
I'm envisioning the bucket hat guy saying this to a girl. So, you think I'm a self-made man, don't you, girl? And she's like, "What? How do you have two different facial hairstyles on your chin? There's two different ones.
You going fishing?
You need
sir?
To choose one of them." And then we haven't even gotten to the hat. We're on a date and you're wearing a bucket hat.
It's high time I'm giving some praise to those that got me where I am today.
Oh, okay. I like this. Yeah.
I got to thank mama for the cooking, daddy for the whooping.
My dad didn't beat me. That's the hot take of the podcast.
Oh, however, okay. Privilege.
I know. I'm not going to say that I didn't live a privileged life. My dad didn't beat me when I was a kid, okay? If he had, it seems strange to me that like one of the main takeaways from that period of my life, I'm like, you know what I need to go out of my way? What's made me the man I am? Really glad to my dad beat me up. I don't think I'd thank him for that. Like maybe he did some other good things. I don't know. But that's not the thing I'm going to choose.
I got to thank mama for the cooking, daddy for the whooping, the devil for the trouble that I get into. I got to give credit when credit is due. I thank the bank for the money. That's the weirdest one.
The weirdest one is that he goes to sit down with the devil to thank him. And the devil's even freaked out by that guy. That guy looks more devilish than the devil. He's like, what's the soul patch and the goatee? I don't get it.
It's like, even I only have a soul patch.
Even I choose one facial hairstyle.
I'm the devil.
I'm the devil. I just have the patch.
He thanks the bank for the money. Hey, Zions, thanks for the money.
That guy walks up into the Utah Community Credit Union at the desk. I just want to thank you guys all for the money that's circulating throughout the economy. Yeah, I sing in a band. It's called Sawyer Brown. You should check us out. But I just want to thank all the people who helped me there along the way.
I thank the bank for the money. I don't get that at all.
Does he think that you can only have money with the bank? Like the bank is just... I don't even understand how that would work.
I haven't used a bank since 1972.
I haven't used a bank since I took away my soul patch, dude.
I would never. I'm all Bitcoin. I've been Bitcoin since
1972. I turned all of my assets to gold and I hid them in the mountains.
I thank the bank for the money and I thank God for you. You get that?
I mean, is he doing this stuff in person?
That's nice.
Is he doing it in person or is it like a text? Is it an email? Is it a phone call?
If somebody said, hey, wrote me like a text, I said, I thank mama for the cooking, daddy for the whooping, the devil for the trouble I get into. I got to give credit where the credit's due. I thank the bank for the money. And then they say, I thank God for you. The first question would be like, you thank the bank for the money. But my second thing I would say is like, that was very sweet of you.
Second question, You know, Lucifer. Okay. How did I get a hold of him? I honestly do have a lot of questions, you know? Is he that misunderstood, or is he is what he is?
This guy's misunderstood.
This guy.
Did you see him? It's the Soul Patch guy who's singing this, right? Yeah, he's misunderstood.
Look, you don't take a band photograph with five people.
Why is the lead singer always the middle?
That's a good why, though. We should do that later this week. The singer always gets the pub.
Because they got the cool facial hair and they got the cool hat. Because
they're pure sex.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. Do you know who's not pure sex? The guy next to him who's taking out the trash every morning. The working pale man!
All right, it continues. A strong heart and a willing hand, that's the secret to my success. The secret to his success is a strong heart and a willing hand.
What's the willing hand? Like, for
I don't know what a strong heart is.
What is that?
Oh, he's not going to get heart disease? We all die from that. We all die.
Do I have unwilling hands? Because I don't like using them a ton.
I'm not willing. My like, hands are not willing.
Like, it doesn't come to mind if somebody goes, do you have willing hands? Are you willing to do anything right now with your hands? No, hell no. There's a ton of things I don't want to do with my hands.
Mm-mm. Yeah, mostly the carpal tunnel, which is ravaging my hands.
Right. Do you want to type on this keyboard more today? No, it hurts.
Ow!
I don't want anything with my hands.
A strong heart and a willing hand, that's the secret to my success. A good woman, I try to be a good man. A good job, Lord, I know I've been blessed. I'm just part of a greater plan. It doesn't matter which part I am.
You know what I don't like? This idea that, oh, every guy's off the rails and every woman's a strong woman who's there to set him straight. What's that all about? That's a thing that every single country music song, they're like, you know, I've danced with the devil and I've done some crazy things, but I need to find me a strong woman to set me straight.
Yeah, I don't get that either.
You can do it yourself. First
that's
of all,
a good point.
That's incredibly rude to her. Let's say you're actually, let's engage, okay? Let's say you're a strong, like, morally upstanding woman. You've been living a good life, normal, cool, learning all your the tricks, whatever your trade is, all the kind of stuff. You're like, I got it going on.
Yeah.
And then the main purpose of you in the song is supposed to be like, oh, that like guy who does a bunch of meth. I need to like take him under my wing and marry him and like turn his life straight.
I don't think it's meth.
Well, just whatever, okay?
Usually it's like, I'm a hellraiser, barn chaser.
Even more intense, I'm a dude who has two distinct facial hairstyles and a bucket hat, and I need to take that guy under my wing and marry him and turn him into like an upstanding citizen? That's an incredible ask of a person.
It is funny. Country musicians are always like, man, I used to do some crazy stuff. You'll never believe I'd get like on my horse, like drunk, and now like I don't do that anymore because I got a strong woman
at home. But only because I got a strong woman at home! And now they're the ones taking out the trash. So maybe the guy on the picture, the one on the right.
That's him.
He's the guy.
That's him 15 years later.
He got the strong woman, the guy with the bucket hat. He's still
No, that is the bucket hat guy. 15 years later.
That's like, Sawyer Brown is one individual after all. It's a time-lapse photograph from five distinct phases of Sawyer's life. And that's what the band photograph is.
Okay, this is how it ends. This is a crazy song. I gotta thank mama for the teaching, daddy for the preaching, the devil for the trouble that I get into. I gotta give credit when credit is due. I thank the bank for the money. Man, he went back to it. I thank the bank for the money. He went back to it. He's like, you know what? Great line.
I have a real big question I want to ask of him. Is he thinking every bank individually, or is he thinking his bank? Because that's
where does he bank? Chase?
I want to know where he banks. That's
Capital
exactly
One? What's in your wallet?
What kind of lines of credit do you think he has, you know? Does he got a $1,000 Capital One card there? Does he got a Visa, like a debit Visa,
ooh,
though?
If he's Visa in and out.
Oh, dude. You can get some cash back on a Visa.
I thank the bank for the money and God for you. That's Country Music Monday. Thank God for You by Sawyer Brown. That's a band, not a person.
Well, we don't know. By the end, we were uncertain if that's a full band.
This guy's thanking the bank for the money.
Here's a really
kinda
good...
doesn't matter.
Here's okay, this is a great idea for a country music band out there. Here's what you do. You replicate in music what Boyhood brought to film. Mm. Boyhood, as everybody knows, really cool film. They filmed it over the span of like 15 years. And they literally would just say, okay, Clinton, Chris, we're getting together once a year and we're going to film. So you see them actually age in real life rather than rely upon the tricks of film, right? Here's the idea based upon what I'm thinking with Sawyer Brown. You sing... Right now, you know, let's say you're a young 20-year-old musician. You dub up a sick track. You don't release anything. 10 years later, you bring in the harmonies. Now it's your 30-year-old voice. Ooh. Okay, 40-year-old. By the time you get to 60, you release the full album of you spanning four decades. And it's a revolutionary new style of music.
I gotta think Wells Fargo in my 20s, Capital One in
and
my
that's,
30s.
That's the great part. It changes the lyrics.
In the 40s.
Imagine if every 10 years they went to you and they said, Clint, who are the five people or entities that you want to thank the most? It always changes. So that by the time you're 60, you're like, I want to thank God for fiber and and Metamucil.
I gotta thank Comcast for the cable.
That's 30. That's 30-year-old. 40, it's like, I gotta thank the bank for extending me a line of credit to buy a motorbike. and the road for giving me a place to ride it. That's a good song.
These guys are cool. Congratulations, Sawyer Brown. They're doing well.
Yeah, I kind of like that song. I do believe they're doing well.
All right, we're going to talk to Ryan Wiedig, who is the CEO and co-founder of Vasion down in St. George. One of the greatest places to go to.
Is it Vasion or Evasion?
I'll be in St. George this weekend. If anybody wants to come, I'll be signing books. I'll be signing Dr. Karen Anderson's books. Yeah, I interviewed her.
You're like, yeah, it's weird that I'm the one signing this.
I'll be signing some books down there in St. George. Come find me. I'm on Clubhouse.
Correct.
Join the Beehive Club.
You can only get on if you're on Apple. But, yeah, I mean, just throwing that out there.
And now Silicon Slopes, but first a word from our sponsor, Chatbooks. I'm here with Vasion CEO and founder Ryan Wiedig. Ryan, how are you?
Good. How you doing?
So good. Thank you so much for coming on. You had a huge announcement. Was it last month you guys did the big groundbreaking or ribbon cutting of this new building that you're in right now and up on Tech Ridge in St. George? You've rebranded from Printer Logic to Vasion. What's going on down there? It's incredible.
Yeah. No. It is. It's been a fun ride. We've been doing a lot of cool stuff. So I don't know. I think maybe tell a little bit of the story of how Tech Ridge came to be. We've talked. I don't know how much you want me to talk about the building. I mean, I can kind of tell that story.
No, I do.
The audience already understands it.
I want everyone to get an understanding of what's happening in St. George, and no one knows this better than you. We held an event. Time is a construct at this point for me. I have no idea what anything is, but we held an event like a year and a half ago, 2 years ago down there, and you could see even well before we held this event, which you organized and Silicon Slopes was a part of, you could see that something amazing was happening down in St. George. You could see that something was building and that there was a community down there that felt to me a lot like what Utah County felt like maybe 6 or 7 years ago. Like there's a real strong community of entrepreneurs and companies down there with you as, you know, leading the charge on that front. So I'd love for you to tell people what's happening in St. George, particularly as it pertains to the tech community.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's a fun story. You know, again, like when Jared said, "Hey, I love the business plan. Come back. Let's partner up. Let's get this thing put together and kind of you know, figure out how to move forward." My first reaction was, "Cool, we're gonna need to move somewhere where there's a tech community," because the kind of like I had lived in Silicon Valley, I had lived in Research Triangle Park, Washington, D.C., and that's where I had done most of my tech career, and I kind of got in that mindset that you had to be in one of those hubs to pick up the phone, recruit the talent, and make everything happen. But one of the things that I found really quickly as we started to recruit was there's like a really special lifestyle going on here. And so also, my generation, right, like kind of being in that 40 zone, and this was – I was 32, I was actually 31 when I came back. Even at that stage, I was like, there's 31-year-olds who have a kid or two, and they're shoving their families into Cracker Jack boxes. And when I was in San Jose, 1,200 square feet, 900 square feet, and they were starting to want to grow families. And I was like, dude, there's major differentiation here that we can create. Like, there's and so as we started recruiting, we really just kind of focused on the lifestyle. Like, okay, at lunch you can go on a mountain bike ride. You can go world class rock climbing. You can go on hikes. You can, you know, there's skiing 45 minutes away. There's Las Vegas an hour and a half away if you need a night on the town. And but you don't have to live in it. It's just, you don't have to live in the snow. You don't have to live in the city. You can do all those other fun things and just live in a resort town in between. And that resonated. It really resonated. The other thing that was really exciting about St. George that I think kind of helped me recruit early on was this idea of saying, like, look, PrinterLogic, 200 people employed, tech company, you know, good revenues, interesting. But like, if we were up north, we'd kind of be an afterthought in a lot of ways. You know, I don't know, you'd know the numbers better than me, but what, like one of maybe 50 companies in that boat, maybe 100, I don't know what the numbers are, but here in St. George, being a company that size, demonstrating that tech can happen, one of the ways that you can recruit really amazing talent is by saying, the mission is way broader than just what you're doing from a company perspective. You literally have relationships with the mayor. Like they know you, they care about what you're doing. It matters to the plan. All the city leaders show up, even the governor shows up, because they know that, like, if we want another economic stake with tech in the ground in the state, like, it's important to kind of foster these relationships and work with folks like us. So the mission becomes broader. It becomes not just what can you do as a company, but what can you do for the community? And as we got growing, like my attitude initially was, yeah, people that said you can't build something in St. George, they weren't really good salespeople and they didn't have really a good company, because this is like so easy to sell that lifestyle and that sense of community. And you know, as long as you have a decent company that's growing at a good clip, like, why wouldn't you be successful? But then when we hit about, I don't know, 75 to 100 people, you start looking around and all of a sudden infrastructure is a challenge. And you realize that, you know, it's fun startup zone. You're able to kind of put people in strip mall situations and whatnot. But then when you hit that next level, you're trying to recruit executives. You're trying to create that fun space that is the next level of fun. Like, early on, nobody cares what you're sitting in or living in. But like, as you get bigger and you get that next level of executive, you want to be able to say, no, we actively put money into creating space that is conducive to creation, not just grinding out entrepreneurial mindset. And you can get those fun creatives in there. And so it did become a challenge. It started to become a challenge of how do we grow this thing to the next level in a town that doesn't really have the kind of space to create that. Dixie ACT, it's a technical college, was moving out from a giant strip mall down near where we were working. And we went to tour that building. It had like 30,000 square feet. And I walked through it with Jarrett. And, you know, Jarrett's very much engineer first. And he looked at it and his attitude was kind of like, you know, we get done, we walk out, and it was kind of like, hey, that's sweet. We could definitely fit 300-400 people in that space if we really crammed them together, and this will work great. And I walked out with a very different, you know, I was coming at it more from a, like, I was at the one actively recruiting and thinking through how do we get the next level talent. And so for me, I had a totally different reaction. I said, like, we can't keep, if St. George wants to become something more, like, I've always said, like, we don't have to be Silicon Slopes, Silicon Valley. That's not the intention. Like, I don't need to say, oh, we're the next. No, we can be whatever we want to be. We can create an awesome little tech garden where it is the community that we want to create. And so as we cultivate that, we do need space that's dedicated and kind of set apart for that end. And Matt Liu is the economic development guy at the time for the city, kind of showing us, because the city owned that building. And I said, you could actually see the ridge, the old airport ridge, from where we were standing as we came out of it. And I said, well, what are you guys doing with that old airport? And Matt looked at me and said, well, actually Dixie ACT is moving up there and they're going to build some space. And we've tinkered with making it a tech hub, but we don't really have the expertise. Like, we don't even know how to do that. And I said, Matt, listen, if I build a building up there and I get up on the third floor And I show people that valley and Pine Valley and Zion's in the background and Warner Valley and Snow Canyon. It's just, I don't know how there's not a person in the world I can't recruit to that. And if we could convert that thing into a tech hub, I think we could do something really special here. And immediately it resonated with him. It resonated with the mayor. Then we had to go sell it to kind of the city. And before I knew it, we had people showing up. They said, let's get a group of the techies in town and let's start the conversation. And so there was kind of a group of probably like 5-10 people at first. And you know, like everybody's like, we're going to build 20 buildings and fill it up with 1,000 people. And, you know, everybody is going to do all this great stuff. And then, you know, all of a sudden you start asking people to write checks and poof, they're gone. Except for some really special people. So Isaac Barlow is one of them, and his company's busy. He had a construction background. He understood how to get kind of development plans put together. So he showed up in a very real way. And then it was iGlobal at the time, but Zonos now, they've converted their name. They're growing like crazy. They said, hey, you know, we're not quite, at the time, they weren't quite in a position to you know, build anything per se, but they said, we will definitely lease space up there at more of a premium cost because we understand the value of that creative space for our employees. And and then we just started going around we had the three of us, and then we had the city people, and we went to Denver to check out what some tech hubs look like in Denver. We went up Salt Lake and looked at how some of the different tech communities, I had the context of like Tyson's Corner, and some of the cool things, you know, obviously Silicon Valley, I saw all kinds of stuff. So we took all of that and we put it together. And my idea was, let's just build a $6 million giant warehouse that I just kind of build out on the inside, and just give me 10 acres. And then I'll just kind of make a campus of hangars basically. And Isaac was the real visionary. He kind of was like, Ryan, that's one way to do that. But and he just kind of brought the CCNR concept to the table and started to help us like up level the thinking. And you know, before we knew it, we had a $15 million building of true Class A. There wasn't really Class A outside of like institutions and healthcare. There wasn't a lot of like true steel framed Class A buildings in St. George. So that was where he took it, and I'm so glad he did, because we master planned. Like, there were 50 acres where Dixie ACT is, and they have a couple of really gorgeous buildings already put up here. And then we broke out 10 acres for the first three buildings with a really cool rotunda in the middle, and those are the 10 acres that we really focused on. Like, let's have this next to the tech college. And then when we master planned the rest out, it was all live, work, play. So we wanted the ridge, the rest of the 150 acres, we wanted it to be a place where there's shops underneath some of the commercial work environment. There's going to be buildings like ours that are just straight commercial workspace. There's going to be really nice high-end condos just to the north of me where I'm looking right now. And the idea just kind of grew into, let's create something special. Let's create a place for the next generation of business in St. George to really flourish. And like you said, last month, after like 4 or 5 years of planning and thinking and dreaming, you know, we have a 60,000 square foot building. And I don't know if there's a place to get some materials, but maybe we could send you some shots to kind of attach to the video. Where people could kind of do a little bit of a virtual tour, walk through some of those pictures of the kind of building that we built. And I think the fun part is the reaction as we brought, you know, Kevin Garn himself was somebody involved who was an important player in really signing off and helping us to kind of get over the hump of, you know, financing the whole thing. And he's just been an incredible partner, actually. And so he came down for the opening and brought a bunch of people kind of in his group. And the consistent feedback was, there's, you know, there might be bigger space, but there's not anything better than this in the state of Utah. Like, this is as good as it gets. And that was a huge compliment. And I think what it says is, you know, just like with anything in life, like you got to kick off that little brother syndrome at some point and say, yeah, we can do interesting, awesome things. And, you know, where we might have disadvantages from a recruitment standpoint, we have major advantages in other areas. And so there's no reason why we can't put a world-class team together. And as you go through the building, you walk through the building, there are very specific values culturally that we have and hold dear. And we've been able to build those into it. So it becomes like this physical manifestation of the cultural values that you've been espousing. And it really helps everybody see it. Why a big fancy building? You know, like you hear that question really early on when you start to dream and say, we need to do something like this. And the way that I've always put it is like, look, if we sold ice cream, nobody in their right mind would say, well, why are you spending millions and millions of dollars in chillers and freezers and forklifts and warehouse space? Like, you would just do that because that's your product. That's your inventory. You have to take really, really good care of it. And when we look at what it is that we do, where is our inventory? What is our product? Our product is sitting in the heads and the minds of these amazing people that come to work every day and try to build on our vision. And so creating a space that is the most conducive possible to unlock that creativity and give them a sense of trust that we believe that they'll use all these awesome amenities and, you know, not abuse them, but use them to responsibly unlock that creativity. It adds a lot of value. And immediately from a recruitment standpoint, the name change has been great from a recruitment standpoint as well. And then you just see that it's just unleashed a whole new wave of excitement and animation for the vision. So
did the pandemic change anything? Like as you think about the pandemic and so many people working from home right now, and you're opening a building, right? Which again is kind of like counterintuitive, which is amazing. It's kind of the St. George way. So how did that change your thinking, or did it not change your thinking at all?
Not at all. I mean, listen, I might be a little bold here or whatnot, but like the reality is the pandemic did not change the fundamental DNA of human beings. It's changed our behavior temporarily. But I can tell you, like, when you send a group of people that have really well-established processes home, it's easy for them to go home, cut out the water cooler talk, and for a temporary period of time, feel a sense of euphoria and massive increases in productivity. But what the dirty little secret is a lot of the micro innovations that occur in those processes happen at the water cooler. They happen at the break room. They happen at people talking on the side, just because they're running into people and saying, oh, hey, I forgot to remind you, like this thing, it's kind of been bothering me, but I've been busy working, but I'm seeing you right now. Like, here's a way I think we could improve this process that we work on together. All that collaboration occurs through those micro meetings that were never planned. And I think that digitally, I think a lot of companies are already starting to wake up and say, yeah, we had plans, but you're gonna come back because a lot of our processes are actually breaking down. Now, that bodes really well for a product like Vasion that helps you with the business process automation to get that locked in, create accountability so that you can scale and so that you can have compliance. Like all that stuff is like that's golden for our product and our value proposition. We're very excited about that moving forward because there will be more of a hybrid approach. I mean, I think companies certainly have learned that there are times to send people home with well-established processes and to get those efficiency gains. But the concept that humans are not going to crave that interaction, those sessions where you're just on a whiteboard figuring things out and engaged with other human beings, I think that is the biggest, you know, I think that is not really going to occur. And I really hope that a lot of people keep going down that path, to be honest, because guess where they move to? When they're told they can work from anywhere, they move to St. George, and guess where they show up 2 years into that working from home experiment, right at our front door. And we're talking about incredible talent because, you know, after a while, people crave it. We see it all the time. We always saw it in small fits, you know, somebody from Microsoft or VMware that was in that situation because they were more senior or more advanced and they were able to do that. But we just see it flooding into our community. And all I see is like just this massive talent pool that 1 year from now is going to be so ripe. And it's going to be perfect timing given where we're at as a company. So it, I hope they keep telling themselves that. I hope they keep trading off some economic short-term gains for, I think, a lot of exposure to people looking for a more normalized human interaction in the future, because it's all to our benefit.
I appreciate you coming on, man. We got to have you on again because there's so much going on in St. George. I tell everyone, like, this is the, maybe this isn't the best way to put it, but it's the next big tech hub, not just in Utah, but I think in the entire country. What's happening in St. George is fascinating. And I think it's only going to grow from here, and what you've built here as a pioneer and Tech Ridge and, you know, being one of the first, you know, major companies to come out of there is just wonderful, man. So keep doing what you're doing. It's always great to see you.
Awesome. Yeah, Clint, always good. Like, just let me know whenever we can talk again. It'd be fun.
Okay. Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it, man.
All right. See you later. Appreciate it.
I gotta thank mama for the cooking, daddy for the whooping. I can't get over Sawyer Brown.
Full disclosure, we may or may not have viewed the Sawyer Brown music video. Kelly brought it over and showed it to us. I think we just need to start talking about country music lyrics every day for every segment.
I got just Sawyer Brown. Mama for the cooking, daddy for the whooping, the bank for the money I get.
The lead singer, who in the picture that we showed was wearing a bucket hat and had a soul patch and a bottom goatee, in the video is wearing a cut-off Phillies shirt, red, tucked into Lee dungarees with a belt buckle. And he's doing these little shuffle, like knobbly shuffles around. And every single scene, it'll show him doing that in a loft where the band is playing. And he wobbles over to some very attractive woman. Then it cuts and it shows the like weird bassist or something. Then it cuts back and he's wobbling somewhere else. And it's a new woman. It's not even about the same woman. There's like 10 different women in the video.
I gotta thank mama for the teaching, daddy for the preaching.
He's going to each of those women, and he's saying that line to him. He goes, all right, so you've probably heard, because you're also here, I just want to say to you directly, I gotta thank the banks for all that money. You know, you seem like an attractive woman. You see.
Anyway, that was Vasion CEO Ryan Wiedig. A lot of cool things happening in St. George. As I mentioned, I'll be in St. George this weekend. I'll be signing autographs of my new book, Mama for the cooking, daddy for the whooping.
Autobiography. Yeah, my dad used to kick my ass. I really want to thank him about that. That's your book? That's so crazy.
I'll be signing. Follow me on Clubhouse at Clint Betts. Join the Beehive Club there on Clubhouse. That's how you get a hold of me in St. George.
Correct.
I only log in St. George.
You're going to be there, dude.
All right. And now, Dear Utah. If you have a question or comment about Utah, email us at dearutah@thebeehive.com. Leave us a voicemail, text us, or contact us on any of our social media at the Beehive HQ using the hashtag Dear Utah. We actually got someone who texted us, and we'll put out how to text us, how to leave us a voicemail, that type of stuff. We got a text today.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Utah, this is a text from Alan. Alan says, does Josh James plan on financially supporting Senator Mike Lee's reelection campaign next year?
Okay. I'm assuming this one's for me.
Yeah.
As a man who's greatly tied into the politics of the area. Yeah, you know, it's crazy because I know so many things about politics, but I don't know the answer to this question, you know? It seems like something that I would know. No, this is my own take on it's not a popular take. People don't like it. I really never care what anybody is spending their money on ever. It honestly will never offend me. It doesn't matter even how crazy it is. I'm just like, what do you want, you know? If you came to me right now and said, Chris, what are you spending your money on? No matter the person, they'd be like, I don't agree with that. I hate that. Oh, and I hate that too. Go down my Visa statement, the debit statement. Oh, no. And that's true for everybody.
Yeah.
But I don't know. That's a long-winded way of saying I don't know.
The answer is, who knows? Who cares? Oh, I don't know.
Why are you asking us?
Clint, I want to know.
I don't know what, how Josh fits this.
You, well, you're tuned into the political game more, so I want an answer from you on this. Why is everybody so fascinated about who donates to who politically?
Well, it's dumb. Like, they tried to get Coach Quinn in trouble for donating to, like, a friend of his who ran for Congress.
Who was that again? Was it Burgess Owens?
Burgess Owens.
Yeah, okay, right.
And he donated, like, $500 or something. And then, like, suddenly Quinn Snyder is, like, a member of the QAnon or something like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It doesn't, I mean, if Josh... does Josh James plan on financially supporting Senator Mike Lee's re-election campaign next year? These are the questions we'll ring around and ask. I appreciate the question. If let me say that. But two, I don't know, don't care.
No.
And I'd be fine if he did or didn't.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat.
Don't you think?
Actually, I take that back a little bit. I'm fine if he did or didn't, but I would like if nobody...
You prefer if he did.
No. I'd be super into it. Me and Mike Lee, actually, good friends. If I wanted to, like, take a stance on this issue, I am some, like, a little, there's a little glimmer of passion in me about, I wish nobody would donate to anybody politically. Mm-hmm. Because it is a huge grift where, like, politicians would just go, all right, you need to show me support and give me, you know, 10 grand or give me $500, whatever, it doesn't matter, but just do this so you can show support for me. No, I don't want to do that. That's the part that I don't like.
Here's the thing about politicians. Kelly, put the camera on me. This is for the whole audience. Here's the thing about politicians. They will let you down.
No.
So, no. So say that...
This is more earth-shattering than what you were saying at the start with the royal family.
So say you want somebody else to be senator in 2022 in the re-election campaign, and you donate to them. That person's going to let you down. Your current one's going to let you down. Any of these people are going to let you down. Don't think about this stuff. This stuff is pointless.
Yeah, I'm trying not to, but...
Try not to think about it.
Look, sometimes I'm awake at night and I just need stuff to fill the time and I start going, who's donating to who?
Mike Lee definitely running for re-election. Mike Lee, favorite to win re-election. A lot of people think he's vulnerable. I think he has a really good chance of being re-elected. He'll have some challenges out there, but who cares who donates to him and who doesn't?
I'm going to donate this year. I'm going to choose a dark horse, you know? At the start of the year in sports betting, sometimes you don't want to go and bet the Lakers or stuff like that's not fun. You go to the bottom and you go, oh, I'm going to bet $2 on the Sacramento Kings to win the NBA title. That's what I want to do in politics. So you're going to have to be my muse. You got to find like the lowliest candidate. Mm-hmm. And that's who I'm going to go to. I'll go, hey, I want you to know, sir, ma'am, you have my full support. And I hand over a crisp 20. And that's how their campaign starts.
No, that'll be public. I've never donated to anything political, even when good friends of mine have run. I've never donated, ever.
Well, here's
I've helped raise money, but I've never personally donated. I never want to be on the record as having financially supported a politician because they will let you down.
Well, here's why I think my idea is a good idea. You give that 20, there's almost without a shadow of a doubt, they're just going to go away in 2 seconds. You know, look at booted into outer space off the ballot, whatever. Let's say there's the 1 in a million chance and they go, oh, actually there's this weird thing and now I'm actually real candidate. Oh, now I'm a congressman. Oh, now I'm a senator. I'm a United States senator. Oh, maybe I'm trying for president. You have such a trump card when it comes to that person that you go, listen, you loser, you'll do anything I say because I was the very first person in the history of the world to have faith in you and donate money to you. So there's a slim chance maybe you have the United States president on beck and call. You call in, you go, hey, you know, let's change some things.
Donald Trump would occasionally get things right. And in the debate, in 2016 in the debate, when he's on the stage and he's a front runner for the nomination, right? And so he's right smack in the middle and there's like 10 guys on either side of him. And he stands up there and this wasn't the point he was making, but he made like unintentionally a great point. He's like, I used to donate to all of these guys. Everyone on this stage, and they do whatever I said because I donated.
That is a great
And he was he was pointing that out as though like he was like doing something special, but in fact, like that's how the system works.
Yeah.
It's like if I don't, those guys will do whatever I say. They all do. Hillary Clinton went to Donald Trump's wedding because he donated to Hillary. Like, what are we talking about? What are we talking about? These are all clowns, these folks. Mike Lee's going to get a challenger. I know one of the challengers.
Is it a $20 challenger or is it more?
There is someone within our community who's going to challenge Senator Mike Lee. There's going to be a few people who are going to challenge him, but it's not going to be easy to beat that guy.
It's not. Now I'm going to warn him. Right, I'm going to warn everybody. It's not going to be easy. However, you need to choose the lowliest one, and that's what my 20 is going to.
But the donating money to politics is an insane thing to do. Personally, this is my own personal take. You can do whatever you want with your money. But donating money to politicians or campaigns, an insane thing to do. We have those goofballs, the Lincoln Project. A few of them live in Park City.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Schmidt, who's like one of the co-founders of the Lincoln Project, said he wanted to run against Mike Lee in Utah just to bring him down a peg. It's like, all right, no one cares. Nobody knows what peg he's on, first of all. So we don't know if he's up or down.
Is it even a peg system? Honestly, we don't know. Peg.
And Steve Schmidt, who's never been like south of Sugar House, you're not going to win. You don't know Utah.
Steve Schmidt does not have my $20.
And you had to resign, and the Lincoln Project's all just a scam. So
that, I mean,
that's what donating money into politics
Wait,
does.
What was the question again?
Don't donate money to politics. That's my personal advice. I'm not a financial advisor. I'm not a lawyer. But I am a happiness expert. And if you want to be happy, don't donate money to politicians. And if Josh James calls me up and says, hey, should I plan on financially supporting Senator Mike Lee's reelection bid? I'll say, do you want to be happy? That's the first question. If he says no, I'll say, go ahead, donate. If he says yes, I'll be like, don't donate.
And then third, you'll be like, why are you picking my brain on this matter?
And third is like,
this is what you wanted to call me
about?
You
don't need to ask me, and I don't care what you do. You can do whatever you want.
It's your life.
With
go
your
live it.
Money.
Go do whatever you want.
With your money, you can do whatever you want with your money.
Well, this will be my final statement on the matter. I do find it interesting that like people like the idea for themselves. They go, yeah, I want to have absolute freedom and go and do the things that I want to do. But then the courtesy is almost never extended to others. It just means if you actually live that lifestyle where you go, I'm going to do what I want, and other people, they're free to do the same thing. That means a lot of people are going to do a lot of things that you don't necessarily agree with. And at that point, you just go, all right, yeah, that's how the world works. That's fine. I'm not going to lose sleep over it.
No, don't lose sleep.
I want to be happy. How do I be happy?
You really should not lose sleep. Sleep is critical.
You're my happiness expert. What should I be doing?
I'm a happiness expert. If you want to be happy, reach out to me. I will tell you how to be happy. That's the show. We'll find out. Great question. We'll find out. I guarantee you I'll find out on whether or not he's going to financially support the reelection campaign. And I'm not going to care about what the answer is.
I might care.
And
yeah,
neither should any of you. Because it doesn't matter. All right. That's the show. Signing off for Chris Rall, Kelly Jensen, and Weston Tanner, who's not even here.
Loser.
Out on, what do they call it? Camp?
Camp Williams. Doinking around.
Day camp? Drill.
He's out there shooting mortars at a mountainside or
I'm
something.
I'm in Army today. He's Buster.
I'm in Army. Look at all my stuffed animals, Mother. That's exactly who Weston is.
My name is Clint Betts, and this has been another episode of The Beehive.